and Tehachapi Mountain, southeast of Bakersfield, experienced respiratory illness. According to an article published by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, three were diagnosed with valley fever. According to Dr. Royce Johnson, about 40% of people develop a respiratory illness that can be mild, and about 5% have more severe outcomes. Most people won't become ill after exposure to the fungus, and of those who do, experts estimate very few actually receive a valley fever diagnosis. According to the most recent data available in the United States, primarily in Arizona and California, there were roughly 20,000 cases of valley fever reported to the CDC in 2019, and an average of about 200 associated deaths each year from 1999 through to 2019. Research authored by Morgan Goris and others has shown that the climate crisis could expand the area in which valley fever is found in California. Morgan Goris said of the research in a high greenhouse gas emissions climate warming scenario, the area endemic to valley fever expanded further north, reaching the US-Canadian border by 2100. She said under a more moderate scenario with less warming and fewer emissions, there is less northward expansion of the disease. She noted, mitigating climate change could mitigate the health effects of valley fever, adding, it's important to understand that it's not just doom and gloom. She added, in California, as the climate shifts to more intense periods of rainfall and then subsequent dry seasons, conditions in which valley fever thrives there could be more cases. Rob Purdue became sick after such a period, a wet year followed by dry weather. He recalls at the time he lived on a few acres on the outskirts of Bakersfield, California, where he frequently spent time outdoors. Valley fever threw his life into disarray. Rob Purdue, who was then a financial planner, struggled to work and had to sell treasured family mementos to support his family as he sought to get a hold on the illness. He was eventually able to find the right treatment, which requires 4 pills a day and medication administered directly into his brain every 16 weeks. It's a difficult treatment that causes him severe vomiting, sometimes to the point of nearly passing out. Rob Purdue sometimes struggles to interact with people and carry on conversations. But he's become an advocate for valley fever awareness and has been able to resume working again. He works for the Valley Fever Institute as a patient and program development coordinator. He said, I have a really severe form of valley fever. The disease can be very terrifying and very debilitating, but I don't want people to be afraid of it. I want people to be aware of it.
سید محمد حسینی بهشتی On December 12, 1925, in a totally undemocratic move, Mr. Reza Pahlavi is appointed the king of Iran. During these days, when the world is taking a fresh breath of temporary peace after World War I, Reza Khan Mirpanch sets his sights on creating fundamental changes in Iran. Different tasks including the construction of a nationwide railway system, banning all Islamic veils, the establishment of Iran's first civil laws and other such activities, the founding of a modern education system is among the first orders of Iran's king, who wears a military uniform. Only a few months after the coronation of the new Shah of Iran, the government is tasked with the development and expansion of education at the elementary level. Old schools under the supervision of clerics are shut down and replaced with schools with teachers who are not clerics and follow the guidelines of Reza Shah's Ministry of Culture. With the establishment of a General Office of Writing, drafting educational books for elementary students begin. The Shah's goal from this action is to unify school books and have direct supervision on what students are being taught at schools across the country. This supervision can be defined in one thing: nationalism and love of the Shah must be included in all school books. In early 1951, when Reza Shah's reign has come to an end and Muhammad Reza Pahlavi replaces his father on the throne, the English teacher at the biggest school in Qom, which is known as the second Dar ul Funun, is a young, well-dressed cleric who wears sunglasses, and people point him out in the streets and say that he can speak a foreign language. Sayyid Muhammad Hosseini Beheshti was born in Isfahan. He was a seminary student at the Qom Seminary School and a university student at Tehran's college. He was talented and an elite student. He chose teaching to make a living. He is not financially well off, but he is very different with the rest of the seminary students. He doesn't charge anyone tuition, writes his daily schedule on a piece of paper, and hangs it up on the wall in his room. His appointments, when to chat with friends, he's even defined joking for himself. When he becomes a top student during his BA course, they propose that he either stay in Tehran and take on an official job or become a teacher in the education system. He chooses teaching and Qom. Because of his command of the English language, the education system accepts him as a teacher at Qom's Hakim Nizami High School. In his memoirs, he writes, "The beginning of my political activities based on Islamic motivations is related to the year 1950. When Ahmad Qavam made his famous bullish speech and I heard it on the radio, I left the house instinctively. It was a very interesting feeling for me. I didn't even know which direction I was going in, but I knew I shouldn't be at home." The nationalization of the oil movement and the link between Sayyid Muhammad Hosseini Beheshti with struggles of Dr. Mossadegh and Ayatollah Kashani are the beginning days of the young teacher's life, which was full of ups and downs. From then on, his presence in many of the political gatherings in Tehran becomes serious. On August 19, 1953, with the defeat of the nationalization of the oil industry through a coup d'etat, many had lost hope. But he would say, "No matter what condition they create, we'll come up with a new plan for it. Our problem is that we do not have enough organized members, and we have to, under the cover of a cultural movement, train them." The same idea, training members, was a spark that helped establish the religious and knowledge of high school in Qom. It was the first school which was established with efforts of the son of the founder of the Qom Seminary, Ayatollah Hayri Yazdi, and the young Sayyid Muhammad Hosseini Beheshti is put in charge of it. Now, with the establishment of the religion and knowledge school, Beheshti's extremely important and serious activities begin. Everything is done under his supervision. The school becomes one of the best schools in the country very soon. Beheshti's seriousness leads to the acceptance of all the students of the school in the entrance exam who had graduated in its first year. But his main goal in this school is training people who will play important roles in movements in the country. The entrance exam shouldn't be a preventive barrier when it comes to the students educated at this school. It's the mid-50s and Sayed Muhammad is almost 30 and successful and well-known. His organized lifestyle helps him juggle a number of activities well and simultaneously. He studies in Allama Tabatabai's classes for 5 years, and Ayatollah Sayed Muhammad Muhaqqiq Damad, who is strict when it comes to calling someone a mujtahid, explicitly calls him one. He also passes the Islamic philosophy doctorate exam held by Tehran University. In 1956, with the establishment of the Intelligence and Security Organization of Iran, known as SAVAK, the heavy shadow of the government casts clouds over the entire country, an organization which becomes scarier and more ghastly by the day. During these years, Beheshti comes up with a new idea: teaching modern sciences to seminary students during the night shift at the Religion and Knowledge School. He believes that seminary students must be educated like literature diploma holders and in being familiar with English, Arabic, and natural studies. This idea attracts about 30 seminary students interested in learning to the Religion and Knowledge School in its first term. Now everyone calls Sayed Muhammad Dr. Beheshti. A doctor who, in addition to all the work and attention that he has in school, is well-read about Islamic economy, the banking system, and issues related to Islamic governance. He even exchanges views and ideas with seminary students and university professors. He sets up a group made up of Mr. Musavi Ardabili, Mahdavi Kani, Meshkini, Hashimi Rafsanjani, Mesbah Yazdi, and others, to produce a scientific and academic research regarding Islamic governance. In March 1961, unexpected news causes grief among the people. Ayatollah Brujerdi has passed away. The death of Ayatollah Brujerdi causes all the people to take to the streets. The huge presence of the people in Ayatollah Brujerdi's funeral shows off how respected the Shia clergy are among the nation. With the death of Ayatollah Brujerdi, the atmosphere of the struggle against the Shah's regime changes and the role of the Shia clergy and seminaries become more solidified. He was in Isfahan and busy visiting his relatives when he was shocked with the news of the vicious attack of the Shah's regime to Faizia school. But he cannot remain silent and sends Imam Khomeini a telegraph from the clerics of Isfahan and condemns this attack with a gentle tone. SAVAK doesn't even overlook this action. He is called in and forced to make a written commitment that he will not interfere in such matters again. On October 3, 1963, SAVAK documents show the following comments. After the incident in Qom and the arrest of Mr. Khomeini, teachers, instructors, and students in the city of Qom encounter new provocations against the government. And one of the provocateurs is Muhammad Beheshti, who has a bachelor's degree in religious studies and teaches at the above-mentioned city's Religion and Knowledge School. What's obvious is that students have been provoked against the government by the aforementioned individual. These provocations have been deemed effective and tangible. SAVAK has officially announced that naming Ayatollah Khomeini in speeches is a crime. But Beheshti ignores SAVAK's announcements and at the end of all of his speeches, prays for the well-being of Ayatollah Khomeini. Finally, in the fall of 1963, SAVAK's worrisome reports create problems for the doctor and cause his forced transfer from Qom to Tehran. But the action may not end up to be a bad thing for him, because now in Tehran, he he has a larger arena to continue his activities. With the murder of Hassan Ali Mansour by the Mutalifa's military wing, more are worried about him. His friends were sure that his name was in Sabak's blacklist because of the Mutalifa, known as the Islamic Coalition Party. They don't want this man with so much ability to become embroiled in a court battle and prison. He receives messages from everywhere to leave Iran any way he can. But he believes he has to stay and finish his unfinished work and research, especially now that they've exiled Ayatollah Khomeini. On the morning of March 23, 1964, Dr. Beheshti left Tehran for Kazimiya. A week later, from Iraq to Jordan, and from then on, he goes to Palestine, Syria, and Beirut. But finally, on April the 11th, he leaves Beirut for Hamburg. In Germany, he uses all of his effort in the prosperity of the mosque and the establishment of the Muslim Students' Union in Europe. The mosque grows bigger, and on March 12, 1966, the union officially begins its work. In the spring of 1970, Beheshti is getting ready to travel to Iran. He intends to return to Germany, but thinks there's the possibility that Savak will not allow it. Even though he's tried to train mosque attendees and the University Students' Union to be independent, he still speaks quite frankly during the last session. "Friends, when I'm gone and my trip takes long, don't ever gather around and say that when I was here, you were able to do some things. If the union is effective with the presence of a certain person, even if it's a person like me, it's best that the union does not exist at all. Your organization has to pave its way, be it with me or without me. Find replacements for forces you lose. You are the creations of the God of the world. You are human beings whose battleground is the world. Don't limit yourselves so much." The teacher comes back to Iran. During these days, the political and religious atmosphere in the country is embroiled by many problems. Just as he had guessed, he was banned from leaving the country. It had been a while that the Shah had been informed that religious school books need revisions. The tiring literature in these books, alongside the bland and difficult fiqh education, had turned this period into the most catastrophic period in schools. And the Shah orders the Minister of Education that the compilation of these books be revised. And the minister looks for people who can help with this revision. She reaches a doctor who many say is very educated and insightful. He has a vision and had spent time in Europe. And that man is none other than Sayyid Muhammad Hosseini Beheshti. The good thing about this is that Mr. Bourghei, the person in charge of the revision at the Ministry of Education, knows the doctor and wants to put together a team made up of Beheshti Bahonar and Golzadeh Ghafori. The doctor likes the work and the team and accepts. Dr. Beheshti is thinking about how to properly teach the main concepts of religion to the students. He even thinks about topics regarding politics and divine leadership. He has no doubt that his cooperation with the Shah's Ministry of Education will make him infamous. But he takes the risk and enters the arena. He says, I preferred this job to teaching as a university professor as a duty and tradition. I told friends that we will take Islamic Jihad to schools through books and pamphlets and religious studies. The Islam that's about how to live and lifestyle, not the Islam that is part of life. Beheshti set a condition for his cooperation. My name shouldn't be printed among the authors. My nature does not allow me to have my name in a book that has photos of the Shah and his family. On March 9, 1971, the teacher starts his new work. Beheshti prepares the entirety of the lesson, and Bahonar and Golzadeh are in charge of preparing the content. At times, they ask Mr. Mutahiri for help. The prepared content gets its final approval by the group. And in the end, they give samples of the book to nearly 1,000 people so they could read them and give them their opinions, from university professors to students. The doctor does the job perfectly and with high quality. He even becomes adamant that the photos in the book are in color. The doctor believes the students must definitely see the red flag of Imam Hussein. Slowly, the books reach the students, not only millions of secondary and high school students across the country, but also their teachers become familiar with a new view and outlook of Islam. Later on, authors of the group hold seminars for teachers in different cities. Beheshti himself teaches the entire book to the teachers once. During these sessions, he's sensitive to know how religion teachers react while reading the textbook, what their opinion and criticism of the textbook is. What he does causes the training of a large number of educated individuals of this influential class. Beheshti says, we were always worried, not out of fear that they'd arrest us and put us in prison or things like that. We were never scared of these things. We were worried that the work we were doing would be left unfinished. With God's help and relying on a well-planned method, we were successful in preparing the last of the books. Exactly after we'd sent that last book for publication, the hellish organization of the Shah found out what we'd done. On April 1, 1974, Savak writes in one of his documents, Beheshti's employment and sensitive but secondary positions of the Ministry of Education is not favorable because of his past political activities. This happens exactly a few days after the female minister's appreciation of Mr. Beheshti for his total seriousness and interest in Iran's school books organization. But it's too late. The books have been published, and millions of students across the country have access to them. Savak asks the Ministry of Education for explanations a number of times. But the revolutionary voices of protest can now be heard from every corner of the country. The years from 1970 to 1976 are six influential years of the presence of the teacher in the systemization of the minds of the students of Iran. Dr. Sayyid Mohammad Hosseini Beheshti, born in Isfahan, a student of Qom's seminary school and a graduate of University of Tehran, known back then as Maqul and Mangul College, a talented genius and a revolutionary fighter. A cleric who's a teacher who started his struggle against Taghut from small classrooms in a school in Qom, and with effort and hard work, made it to the highest positions of influence in the Ministry of Education. And in the end, he was able to train a generation whose freedom-seeking and fighting injustice spirit was heard by the entire world, the huge revolution in Iran.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
It appears that we're in for another week of pins and needles, waiting for court filings in the case of Donald Trump's stolen classified documents, which prompted the FBI to get them to a safe place away from where odd wandering MAGA fans and foreign spies can get to them. The article you're about to hear has been written by Heather Digby Parton. Heather Digby Parton is a columnist for the website Salon.com. The article is titled, Trump's Threats of Riots and Violence Shows He's Desperate, Knows Legal Case is Weak. It appears that we're in for another week of pins and needles, waiting for court filings in the case of Donald Trump's stolen classified documents, which prompted the FBI to get them to a safe place away from where odd wandering MAGA fans and foreign spies can't get to them. The affidavit for the search warrant was released last week and showed that the government had tried for months to get Donald Trump to give the documents back, and he either lied, saying everything had been returned, or made fatuous excuses as to why the government had no claim to them. Next week, we can expect that the Department of Justice will respond to a different judge's request on Trump's behalf that they show why they don't need to appoint a special master to determine if any of the documents should be shielded by executive privilege. If so, that could take months, so Donald Trump's usual delaying tactics may succeed once again. But importantly, that's the only success that he's having at the moment. Donald Trump and the Republicans originally thought the FBI's search of Mar-a-Lago would be a big help for his and the party's political fortunes, so they immediately jumped upon it, screeching that the FBI was acting like the Gestapo and predicting the beginning of a civil war in America. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, a Republican, superciliously declared the raid on Mar-a-Lago is another escalation in the weaponization of federal agencies against the regime's political opponents. But it's not looking like the big winner that they thought it was. CBS News polled the question last week and found that a large majority, including 20% of Republicans, believed the search was done to protect national security and not to persecute Donald Trump. Then this week, the Sunday news show suddenly had trouble finding Republicans who were willing to compare the FBI to the East German Stasi, or the Department of Justice's decision action to Stalin's Great Purge. Retiring Senator Roy Blunt, appearing on ABC's This Week program, reluctantly admitted that he should have turned the documents over, and apparently He turned a number of documents over before petulantly whining about the government waiting until it was close to the election before seizing them. The government, from nearly all accounts, was trying to give the former president a way out of the mess, and he refused to take it. And more directly, to Senator Roy Blunt's complaint, Donald Trump is just a disgruntled former employee at this point sitting on a bunch of highly sensitive national security documents at his resort hotel. He's not on any ballot in November. Both New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu and Maryland Governor Larry Hogan, both widely touted as moderate Republicans, also hemmed and hawed that maybe the FBI did the right thing, but then maybe they didn't, and that we need transparency, and that it's difficult since this is a matter of national security. Their discomfort was palpable. Nobody knows just how bad things will turn out to be. Since that first day when the entire Republican participated in their mass primal scream, we've learned that Donald Trump has stashed at least 700 documents, some of them marked with the most top-secret designations that exist. That's very difficult for the Republican Party that's been chanting "lock her up" for the past 5 years to defend. Donald Trump, meanwhile, has been throwing everything at the wall on this one, and none of it seems to be sticking. The political benefits aren't materializing, while the legal threat he faces is so very real. So he's now deploying his most dangerous strategy, one he hinted at right after the search when he sent a cryptic message to Attorney General Merrick Garland. President Trump wants the Attorney General to know that he has been hearing from people all over the country about the raid on Mar-a-Lago. If there was one word to describe their mood, it's angry. The heat is building up. The pressure is building up. Whatever I can do to take the heat down, to bring the pressure down, just let us know. According to the New York Times, this strange message had the senior leadership at the FBI befuddled. I actually doubt that. These are people who prosecute mobsters all the time, and they know a veiled threat when they see it. And it's certainly not the first time they've encountered it with Donald Trump. They're in the midst of the largest investigation in history with the January 6th insurrection cases, which are a direct result of Donald Trump's incitement. He was letting the Attorney General know that he might have to unleash his mob yet again if they pursue this case. And they know it.
Hidden Files. Over 80% of the world's population uses one of these, a smartphone. But what over 80% of the world's population probably never thinks about is the true cost of the cobalt used in the batteries of smartphones, laptops, and electric vehicles. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashemi. And today we're going to tell you a story of hands. Hands that have for long been hurt beyond imagination while harvesting the main ingredients to our industries. But before we start today's story, we need to properly set the scene. Because though the country we're going to talk about is home to one of the poorest nations in the world. The land itself is perhaps the richest land on earth, or the country in question. The Democratic Republic of Congo, the country with the most abundant resources known on earth, and yet home to one of the 10 most impoverished nations in the world. But it was at the hands of these impoverished people that Europe experienced its industrial boom in the late 1800s. And it all started with some of the same trees that you saw in the picture, the rubber tree. From bicycle tires to industrial bands, rubber played a big role in answering Europeans' daily demands, especially with the rubber boom in the mid-1800s. But rubber does not grow in Europe. And that's where the story of a Belgian king and his Congo comes in. The story about the toil of hands and their unlikely reward. Now, who was this Belgian king we're talking about, and what did he do?
King Leopold II was born to the first royal family following Belgium's independence. He seized Congo with the help of the explorer Henry Morton Stanley in mid-1880s. The king and his forces drained the land of resources, killing elephants for ivory and cutting down trees for rubber. The United States became the first country to recognize his claim to the Congo. Congolese hands were systematically amputated during his rule. The severed hands were then collected and smoked by the colonists to be preserved for later counting and recording. King Leopold was responsible for the biggest genocide in history, with 10 to 15 million killed by torture, famine, and diseases, and many others systematically maimed. The king was honored with Great Britain's most prestigious title, a member of the Order of the Garter, in 1916. Thousands of signatures and recent protests by Belgian people have called for the removal of his statues and the payment of reparations to the victims of the colonial crimes.
The people were clearly being punished for something, but that something was neither negligence nor a crime. Their Belgian masters had decided a certain rubber quota for them to harvest, and they had failed to reach their quota. But it wasn't only these slaves who had to pay for this failure. Let's just say the Belgian punishment system for the Congolese who hadn't met their quota included cutting off the hands and feet of their loved ones. According to statistics, between 10 to 15 million Congolese were killed by King Leopold II during his 23 years of ownership of Congo. And though this number is millions more than the number of those killed in other genocides, few people know about Congo's Holocaust. At the time, this genocide committed by the Belgians slashed Congo's population in half. Imagine that, half of the population gone. But it's best to hear about all of this from one of our guests today, who is a historian specializing in colonialism in Africa.
Brothomeo Gabriel is an activist and a member of an anti-colonialist imperialist organization called No White Saviors in Uganda. He specializes in African history, and with the organization, they have opened a Pan-African library in Kampala. He's also a social media expert and uses this specialty to educate the masses about the true history of Africa.
Thank you so much for being with us on the program today. Can you talk about the legacy of the Belgian king, King Leopold II, that legacy that he had on Congo?
We first have to highlight how, unlike other colonies, or unlike other entities that were classified as colonies, Leopold classified the Congo as a private property. It's vast land that had people on it, that had resources, that had landscapes and animals, was essentially the private property of one individual. And with that came his self-imposed right to do whatever he saw fit to exploit the people of the land however he saw fit. And the fact that it was private property meant that even the Belgian government, if I may say, at that time, all the Belgian political bodies didn't have a right to dictate or to interfere in whatever decision he took. And we see that with this came a reign of terror for the Congolese people, for the Congolese, Rwanda, and Burundian people. Because when we often talk about the Congo talk about Belgium, we often leave out the fact that Rwanda and Burundi also faced similar atrocities at the hands of the Belgians.
I mean, it's estimated up to 15 million Congolese were killed during Leopold's reign. Do you think that these numbers are accurate?
It could have possibly been more than 15 million. I'm one of the people who believe it was more than 15 million because when you look at the systemic situation as it was, the fact that for every hand that was chopped, it had to be accounted for. Every bullet that was fired had to be accounted for. So that meant taking back the arms of the victim or the hands of the victim back to the force public officials. I think that's how the force was referred to at that time. I'm not quite good with my French isn't quite good. But you see that the institutional or systemic system as it was at that point promoted violence against the Congolese people. For any small thing, you could have fallen short on your rubber collection and, you know, your child would pay the price or your family member would pay the price. Even you yourself would pay the price. So imagine that going on for years, day in, day out, years. It's easy for anyone to see that 10 million is an understatement.
What exactly is happening today in Congo? Because we see growing calls by the Congolese for the United Nations to even leave the country.
Yes, they are cries by the Congolese population to have MONUSCO expelled. I think MONUSCO is the UN mission in Congo, something like that. And it isn't for, and this cause is for a justified reason by the Congolese people, that throughout the decades that the MONUSCO has been active, they have questioned their input because the Congolese people are being slaughtered. And oftentimes you see that the MONUSCO entity doesn't act, or the UN entity doesn't act, only when it benefits them. I don't know if you're aware, but I think it was last year, a UN truck in the eastern part of the Congo overturned, and out of the vehicle came bags of minerals. So for the Congolese people, they are literally tired of being exploited. They're literally tired of this pseudo-sense of we're here to protect you, because that is not what is ongoing. The UN is plundering the wealth of the Congolese people, the wealth of the Congolese land.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today on Hidden Files. So many of the horror stories in Congo's past involve rubber slavery. The oppression of this nation today has far more to do with another type of resource. You see, in addition to its limitless water supply, rich forests, and fertile soil, Congo is home to some of the world's most precious and most used minerals. Congo has abundant mineral deposits of cobalt, gold, diamonds, petroleum, potash, lead, zinc, uranium, copper, phosphates, gold, manganese, natural gas, coltan, and a whole lot more. Congo's untapped raw deposits of raw materials are actually estimated at being $24 trillion. Imagine that, $24 trillion. And Congo is the world's fourth largest producer of copper, copper that we use so much in this modern world of ours. 60% of the coltan on the planet, the reserves are in Congo. And perhaps most importantly, the country produces 70% of the world's cobalt, which is used in phones and laptops and other high-tech tools. You see, it's the Congolese who are the true owners of the cobalt. It's the Congolese who harvest it with their hands in unsafe mines. And it's the Congolese who suffer all kinds of health issues and birth defects as a result of this dangerous hands-on approach to cobalt harvest. And yet, in 2018, over 70% of the Congolese lived on less than $1.90 a day. Clearly, even though their country is no longer the private property of a Belgian king, they continue to have little to no share in their rich national resources. But how is this happening today in what's now called the DRC, or the Democratic Republic of Congo? Our next guest has some interesting answers, so let's find out more.
Tede Kofi is a broadcast journalist with credits on the BBC World Service and BBC Radio 5, where he presented Current Affairs magazine programs. Tet is a newspaper publisher and ran the Ethnic Media Group, publishing Asian and Afro-Caribbean titles. He has been a crisis, media coach, and consultant for multinational corporations, specializing in the arena of diversity management.
Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. We appreciate you being with us today on the program. I want your assessment of the effects of Leopold Rain you think could have had on the overall psyche of the Congolese.
The barbarity, the savagery, and the cruelty that Leopold II wreaked on the Congo is one of the world's best-kept secrets. It is estimated that 10 million Congolese died, that he reduced the population of the country by about 70%. In the early days of Leopold, each Congolese man, able-bodied man, was supposed to produce 15 kilograms of rubber per day. If he did not produce that, his family would be rounded up, herded, and killed. And so if people didn't produce their quota, their hands were amputated. There were these bizarre scenes of people presenting like strings of male genitalia, Congolese male genitalia, just to show how many people that they had killed that day because they hadn't made their quota. Now, all of this was covered up by Leopold as an exercise in civilizing the savages, which we Africans were presented as. So he said that basically in the Congo Free State, which is basically my private fiefdom, I've gone over there to introduce them to God and Christianity. And of course, the missionaries were under dire admonitions never to reveal the truth, which of course ultimately leaked, because as slavery was abolished elsewhere, people started to ask questions about how Leopold was running this enterprise. And of course, the whole thing blew up in his face, and he then had to resort to burning all the national records to try and cover up and hide a genocide, which was, you know, in plain view. So again, this is another way in which, if you have lived through that kind of, let me call it a Holocaust, it's probably the greatest human genocide kind of in living memory. If you've been through that kind of genocide, the idea is to instill in the people obedience to authority and power.
How is it, though, that the exploitation of the Democratic Republic of Congo is still existing today, has taken place for so long a period of time?
The oldest playbook in the oldest method in the playbook of any totalitarian or any controller is divide and rule. Divide and rule requires that because there are few of the abusers, you must get the people you are abusing to fight each other. As long as they are fighting each other, they cannot unite, because it is only when they are united that they can kick you out of your position of authority, command, and control. And so it is that Congo has always been destabilized by foreign powers and foreign interests who have a profound desire, but whose lifestyles are determined by the cheapness with which they can extract the strategic minerals that I listed before.
Right.
And so that is how it's played out for the Congo. And another way is to make sure that you have proxy governments which are propped up by foreign powers, doing essentially the bidding of the foreign powers, so that they can be the natural and easy exfiltration of the nation's wealth to the benefit of the foreign powers. So that's how it's always played. Divide and rule, proxy governments which are created by the foreign powers, and thus it has been to this very day. In fact, now there is another challenge, because colonialism moved to another stage when, by using local agents, the destabilization could be maintained. And even now, if you speak to any Congolese, they will tell you that the role of Rwanda is a very difficult one in their country. And many Congolese blame a lot of the conflicts, internal conflicts within the country, on the actions not only of the Rwandese, but also of the Ugandans.
Well, why haven't we seen reparations for the Congolese after all of the suffering that they have gone through?
For a crime to be expunged, you need recognition that the crime happened, you need regret for the crime happening, and you need recompense. Now, in terms of recognition of the crime happening, my goodness, if you ask anybody what comes out of Congo, what they'll tell you is Makalele, Vincent Kompany, Lua Lua, and Romelu Lukaku, their top football players. Most people in the world don't even know what the history of the Congo is beyond some trite superficial modernities. In terms of regret, when the tooth of Patrice Lumumba was handed back to his family, here is the thing. There was no official apology, either on behalf of the Belgian state or on behalf of Leopold II, who committed most of those atrocities. So there is no regret there. And as for compensation, well, Congo's wealth is still being filched out of the country on a daily basis. And the parties who benefit from this are absolutely adamant about the maintenance of their profits. So it's a perfect storm for Africa's richest country. And you've got to think about the bigger picture as well. When Nkrumah stood up in Ghana, the independence of Africa was signaled. When Lumumba stood up in the Congo, the independence of the Congo was signaled. And the thing about these things is that they attract people who follow the cause. And so it is important in the interest of the controlling powers that Congo doesn't become as wealthy as she can be. What if then she starts supporting the rest of the other African countries, and then the yoke of colonialism will be broken one by one by one across the continent? If you want to defeat an enemy, you first defeat their champion, and Congo can be the champion of Africa. Just indeed, as Muammar Gaddafi could have been the champion of Africa. Look what happened to him.
Well, what is it going to take, in your perspective, to turn around the fate of the Democratic Republic of Congo?
All I can say is that if people are severely abused over a long period of time, it takes time for these people to heal, for them to find their center, and to make demands based on their own self-validation. So that work has to take place. But that work has to take place right now in the face of overwhelming media coverage, which makes sure that the only things people associate Congo with is Claude Makélélé and Victor Kompany, football players. People don't know outside of Africa the value and the condition of Congo. So all of this applies very, very negative pressure. On the other hand, the international community must write a new set of rules. And that set of rules should mean that all people, as said in the United Nations Charter, deserve respect and recognition. But at the moment, you know, the world is run by what one cartoonist called the golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules. And so as long as you've got this sort of moral relativism, it's going to be very challenging.
Thank you so much for being with us, Mr. Tete Kufi. Appreciate it. But when we talk about the advancement of technology, we often think of prestigious universities and creative minds. Unfortunately, we rarely remember the suffering of hands without whose harvest the main ingredients of advancement would be missing. Hands like those of the Congolese that were cut off for the sake of rubber and the harvest of cobalt. The pain must be acknowledged and the price be paid. But from the Belgian monarchy that has brought about the genocide of the Congolese to the international corporations and various countries that continue to profit from the toil of the Congolese and the taking away of their resources, no entity has acknowledged the crime committed against these people, let alone apologize. Yet even a formal apology can hardly ever appease the victims of such horrible crimes. What good would an apology have done, for instance, the Congolese man who had to stare in shock at the severed body parts of his 5-year-old daughter? I can't even begin to imagine. Well, a true apology must be followed by a change in actions and in reparations, such as those that has for decades been paid by German citizens to those related to victims of Nazi atrocities. Perhaps someday soon, the oppressed nations of the world will begin to have the power to extract this apology from colonial powers of the past and present. But this power requires knowledge. For now, though, that's goodbye for me and all the crew right here at Hidden Files. Thank you so much for being with us, and let us hear from you, from your corner of the world. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.